Greetings, you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, maybe the biggest news of the past week is going on right under our noses today and tomorrow. That's the G20 meeting, of course, in Osaka, Japan, where Trump is scheduled to meet with China President Xi here tomorrow about the trade war, which is on everyone's radar screen right now because it's beginning to clearly bite what's going on. And we'll see what happens here, but it's going on right now and it's biting. Well, okay, let's talk about this a little bit. Well, what's going to happen? No one knows for sure, but pretty clearly, I don't believe there'll be an agreement. Okay? I don't think there will be an agreement because the fundamentals aren't there for an agreement. What are the fundamentals? Well, for the Chinese, it's Trump has to back off of his trade tariffs that he insists on keeping his trade tariffs. He says he's not going to do that. It looks like now that's a typical strategy by Trump to keep the tariffs in his pocket as a hammer even after an agreement is reached. We saw that with the question in what went on in Mexico here recently. You know, we have this Canada-US-Mexico trade deal supposedly agreed to. And what's happened with that? Well, Trump threatened more tariffs on him. So even though this is a trade deal, it's pretty clear that there's a tariff in the back pocket. Okay, and he's going to keep those tariffs to whipsaw and to enforce and to reopen negotiations whenever he likes it, because that's the way Trump negotiates. There is no deal. You know, the art of the deal is that you never really have a deal. That what you do is reopen it whenever you like it. Well, we see that politically as well going on globally with the U.S. And, of course, you know, economically, it's the same thing. You can't reach a deal with Trump. There's no such thing as a deal because it's always open-ended. Always open-ended. Okay, so I think the U.S. will not back off of the trade deal and to tariffs, will not back off of tariffs, and we'll see what happens here tomorrow or this weekend, but I don't think Trump is going to concede to withdraw all the tariffs if there's a deal with China, and if that doesn't happen, I don't think China's going to fall for that, because it's pretty clear that what we see already going on is just that, right? Tariffs. He likes tariffs. He likes tariffs because it generates income for the U.S., revenue for the U.S., but he likes tariffs because this is his way of reopening negotiations whenever he feels like it. You can't strike a deal with the U.S. and Trump anymore. A deal's not a deal. It's that simple. So, I think what's going to come out of this is a lot of happy talk. There will be exaggerated conclusions to this meeting. Trump will put a positive spin on it. And probably all you're going to get from it, I think, is, okay, our parties have agreed to trade teams to meet again. In other words, kick the can down the road, put a nice gloss over it. With some, mutual statement that things, were going well and so forth, and now our teams are going to follow up. But that will just be a gloss. That's all that is. Okay. China will not strike a deal, I don't think, unless significant release of these tariffs. And the other sticking point with China might be Huawei. China is demanding that the U.S. Back off on attacking Huawei. That's the Chinese telecom company. But I don't think that will happen at all. That train has left the station for the U.S., and for the U.S. To back off of that would really put egg on its face, since Pompeo's running around everywhere in Europe and places and insisting that everyone else give the deep six to Huawei as well. The U.S. is not going to back off on the Huawei concession, nor will Trump probably reduce his tariffs. Okay, so that's our problem from the Chinese side, and I don't expect there'll be a deal. Trump probably does not want a deal until well into next year anyway, if there is to be a deal. As far as he's concerned, the U.S. economy is doing well, because for him, the economy is the stock market. And yeah, the stock market just keeps hanging up there, doesn't it? It doesn't really correct. Well, I think that's due to two fundamental reasons. You know, one, over 80% of all the trades are done by institutional investors now, and they're flush with trillions of dollars in their pockets, and they got to make them work. And whenever you have a reason for a contraction in stocks, 5, 10%, whatever, that's a buying opportunity, and they throw their money back in, and there goes the stock markets back up. Also, I think a lot has to do with the buybacks and dividend payouts that are driving the demand for financial assets, particularly stocks. And we see that going on right now as well. Well, that drives up a fundamental floor, driving up or maintaining stock price levels. Well, how much is that? Well, you know, last year, 2018, $806 billion in just the S&P 500 stock buybacks, $806 billion. Add on that another $500 billion in dividend payouts. So $1.3 trillion shuffled off by corporations to their shareholders, $1.533 trillion. I think that's going to about $1.5 trillion. It certainly is running as run rate about $900 billion in buybacks. And now, this past week, the Federal Reserve just gave the green light to the banks to go whole hog on buybacks, buying back their stock. And a report just came out that just the big four commercial banks, I'm talking about J.P. Morgan, Wells, Citi, and Bank of America, maybe not Citi, but certainly just the big four, have announced $100 billion of new stock buybacks this year. And, you know, dividends are usually one-third equivalent of stock buybacks, so they'll probably do that too. So $150 billion more in buybacks this year just from four banks. Right. What about the other 27 or 31, I think it is, financially large financial institutions, according to the Fed? Well, they're going to do the same, because if they don't, investors will just buy the stocks of those big four. And then what about second-tier banks, of, you know, which there's more than 50 or maybe 100 second-tier banks? You know, they're going to have to do the same, too. So we're looking at $200-300 billion just in bank buybacks okayed by the Fed this year. It's part of the deregulation going on, you know, part of this stress test, phony stress test they've just done. Okay, so, you know, what we've got is $1.5 trillion likely in stock buybacks this year. Well, that's going to prop up the stock market, right? That's for sure. And if the stocks are good, you know, Trump's going to think everything's fine. You know, I can keep taking the risks here with a global trade war. with China, because U.S. economy is doing fine. Yeah, is it? No. If you look beyond the stock markets, it's not. The stock markets are totally divorced now from the real economy. There's so much money, capital, been pumped into the economy, so much big tax cuts going on, so much low interest rates by the central bank, so much money flowing in globally as the rest of the global economy slows down into U.S. markets here, the markets are being driven totally artificially. They're not linked to performance, real performance of companies anymore. It's a big problem. It's a problem of 21st century global capitalism. Its financial markets have been delinked from its real economy. So what about the real economy in the U.S.? What about it? Well, let's look at the U.S. here. As we've said in previous shows, this 3.1% GDP growth of the first quarter was totally artificial, or temporary at least. Well, what does that mean? Well, maybe 1.5 or more percent of the 3.1 was due to trade war matters. 90.941% of it had to do with excess exports over imports. In other words, the trade war slowed down imports into the U.S., and that artificially boosts GDP. Doesn't mean we produce more. It's one of those quirky things about GDP calculations. You just reduce your imports, your GDP goes up. Doesn't mean you produced more. Okay, so that was a big chunk of that 3.1%. Another big chunk was inventories. Businesses built up their inventories in expectation of continuing consumer and business demand. That was like more than a half of 1%. Okay, so then the government war spending went up $100 billion. All right, you take those three elements, particularly the first two, and you got a GDP, real GDP, maybe 1.3, 1.4%, a slowdown going on. The boosting from inventories and net exports were temporary, as we see now already in the second quarter. Those two elements have faded. They've gone away. And what do we see in the second quarter so far? We only have April, May. Housing continues 17 months of slowdown, of a decline in growth, 17 months, ever since Trump came on, roughly. Well, December 2017, since then, it's slowed down every month. What about manufacturing? Well, big problems here. And it's not only the collapse of orders for Boeing and its aircraft. If you look at non-defense capital goods in April, they declined by 1%. May, we don't know. Durable manufacturing, okay, that's been declining 1% to 3% both the last 2 months, April and May. Factory orders down 2.1% in May. Manufacturing activity flat or negative in several Fed districts now, New York, Philadelphia, Maryland, Chicago, all flat and declining. Consumer spending in the first quarter revised down to only 0.9%, less than 1% gain year on year in consumer spending. That was in the first quarter. We'll see what's going on now. Fourth quarter, by the way, it was 2.5%. It revised downward here in the latest GDP numbers from 1.3 in the first quarter. Consumer spending only 0.9%, less than 1%. Services, which is 80% of the economy, only growing at 1% now. 1%. That's we haven't seen that in quite some time. All right, so manufacturing down 12% of the economy, housing 8% of the economy, consumer spending, which is 2/3 of the economy, almost flat, business spending, non-defense capital goods negative, business confidence, consumer confidence all slowing, inflation, goods inflation, goods and services, which is an indicator of slowing demand, down now to 1.5%. Revised downward from 1.8 annually. And, of course, we saw the job numbers here last month well under 100,000. Well, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens next Friday. Next Friday, when we have the next May or June results for jobs. You know, will it be a snapback in jobs? Because clearly now jobs, always a lagging indicator, have begun to catch up with the rest of the economy. And it'd be interesting to see what really happens here following Friday. Should it be significantly under 100,000 again, watch out. Red flags will go up everywhere. All right. So the U.S. economy is slowing, stagnating, and even declining in certain areas. Now, of course, that's the real economy, as we say, not the stock markets or bond markets, which are divorced from the real economy now. You know, but Trump thinks that's what's important, you know, the stock market to him. Big speculator, he would, you know, he would consider that. Of course, he's not too sharp when it comes to economics anyway, but, you know, whatever makes money for speculators is the indicator of what the economy is, right? Yes, that's where the thinking now is among most of the big capital in this country, right? The hell with the rest of the country, hell with the rest of the economy, as long as we're making money from financial assets, that's all that really matters. Well, what about China's economy? Well, that too is slowing. Its target officially is 6.5% this year, but in recent months, everything is more like in the 5% range, low fives. Investment is in industrial production only at 5%, and that's official data. So the real data in China is probably around 4, maybe less. It's slowing down, right? Imports declined 8.5% in May. Exports are down. Manufacturing output is the weakest since 1992. That's why China is pumping up its housing market again, which always results in bubbles. And then when it stabilizes, the economy stabilizes, they go and they try to stop the bubbles. It's like a whack-a-mole policy in China since 2015. Boost up the economy with fiscal stimulus quickly and big amounts of free money to residential and local investment, you know, get the economy back up. And that produces bubbles. And now we got to do something about the bubbles when they get the GDP back up and they go after the speculators and the shadow bankers. And that slows down the economy. And they go back and forth that way. That's been for 5 years now. Okay, so China economy slowing. If Trump ever really realizes the U.S. economy is slowing, that may be the impetus to force both China and the U.S. to some sort of compromise and trade deal. But that's not going to happen this weekend, I don't think. Maybe later this year, and quite possibly, if not in 2020, because Trump wants the deal. But the Chinese aren't falling for his tactics anymore. You know, he could beat up on little Mexico with his tariffs because Mexico, 80% of Mexico's exports go to the U.S. It's totally integrated with the U.S. economy now. So he can beat up on them with a threat of tariffs for whatever he wants, and he'll do it again. You know, he did it not too long ago here over the immigration issue, right? Threatened tariffs if Mexico doesn't pay the price and stop the immigration from its southern borders, right? He can do that with Mexico, maybe even Canada, but he can't do that, can't pull that game off with other places in the world, particularly with regard to China. So we'll see. As we have said many times in the past, other big issues have been resolved with China. China's agreed to buy $1 trillion more U.S. Goods, which would significantly reduce the trade deficit in goods. China has allowed 51% ownership, which will increase the services surplus of the U.S. in trade with China. As more bankers move in on China there, those are big issues that the big capital wanted, especially big bankers in the U.S., and they got them already. But the crux of the problem is the technology issue, and the neocons in this country don't want a deal with China unless this capitulates on the tech issue, next-generation technologies, 5G, cybersecurity, AI. Those are not only the industries of the future and the competitive sources of the future, but it's also the military technologies of the future. And the neocons want to stop China in that regard. They don't want to deal with China unless it capitulates on tech. And, of course, that's all you got in the Trump administration now, neocons, right? Bolton and Abrams and Miller and all those guys, Lighthizer even, Navarro, they're all hardliners, big risk takers, right? Let's go to war with Iran and we'll figure it out later, right? Yeah. So, by the way, why did Trump back off of Iran? Well, I think because if he had instigated something, he would have blown up the G20 meeting with Xi, right? He's still inclined towards taking some action there, and we'll see what happens, in the Straits of Hormuz there. But I think he just backed off for the obvious reason that he was going to wait until after he sees what happens with this thing with Xi. Negotiators, once again, with the U.S., whether it is they're the North Koreans or anybody, China, et cetera. They look at the U.S. and agreement's never an agreement with this guy. Why should we agree to anything, right? Always breaks the agreement whenever it's convenient. Well, that's how he ran his companies, That's how he ran. He borrowed the money from the New York bankers for his companies, even to bail them out because they were bankrupt in the 90s. And then he reneges on paying it and reopens negotiations to try to lower his debt payments. And he said, I'll pay you part of it, That's why the New York banks wouldn't loan him any more money, and he had to go to Deutsche Bank and the Russian oligarchs to get money. Right? That's the Russian connection there. The oligarchs. Yeah. And Deutsche Bank, which did all the laundering for him. Anyway, well, that's a political issue we talked about before. So, will the economy's weakening enough to force China and the U.S. back to negotiations and a deal? Not yet. Maybe later this year, if the real economy in the U.S. gets significantly worse, and ditto in China, even more likely early next year, so he can say to his political base, see what I did, I got tough and I got this and I got that, And of course, he'll lie about what he got. Okay, other problems globally here. Watch what's happening with India. India has a problem, or it has problems, right? It was touted here recently as the fastest growing economy in the world, even faster than China. 6% plus, or 6.5, 7, I don't know. I never believed those numbers because I think it was 3 years ago, what India did was simply redefine its GDP to get a higher GDP number. It doubled GDP. And people I know, investors from India, kept saying, we don't believe those numbers. Just divide it by two, and then you're maybe close. Well, there was a big flap here not long ago, a week or two ago, where one of the insiders blew the whistle and said, it's all phony. It's not 7%. It's about half of that. Yeah, well, governments play games with their statistics, right? They tweak them. They don't outright lie about it, maybe, but they tweak them and bend them and, you know, whatever suits them politically. And India was especially egregious in that regard. But India also has problems with its shadow banks now and non-performing bank loans. Big trillions of dollars in non-performing bank loans in India. I don't know exactly how much because they kind of shield it. And, you know, all these governments, they play games by redefining what a non-performing loan is. Italy's a good example, right? Italy significantly reduced its trillions of dollars in non-performing bank loans by saying, well, you know, a non-performing loan is really not a loan that's not been paid in 2 months. It's a non-performing loan that hasn't been paid in 3 months. And we'll call the 2 month and the 1 month non-performing, and there was no payments on principal and interest. We'll call that something else, right? And so that's how they reduce it. Or what they do, and Italy's trying to do, is get the banks to sell those non-performing loans for pennies on the dollar to U.S. Hedge funds and so forth, vultures, right? Let them buy it up, and then they go after. Long-term, they go after the owners, or they take over those companies and dice them up and sell them off to get their payment. Okay, so non-performing loans, big problem, right? So big that the central bank chairperson there, I forgot his name, resigned, right? And now there's a trade war maybe brewing with Trump, right? Trump is a going after them as well, or at least putting pressure on it, but his statements, right? So it's easier to go after a China or an India than it is to strike up a war with a Japan and or Europe, right? Those will be last. Those are phony deals anyway. Okay. So non-performing bank loans, shadow banking, stability, fragility in India, is a problem, along with the same non-performing loan problem in Europe, which is significant, trillions of dollars, in Japan as well. In Europe, it's more serious. So I would add India to the EU as a locus point of instability in the next crisis. Also, of course, you would have to put Argentina and Turkey and South Africa, maybe Brazil, in that same category here. So we'll watch what's going on in India, although it's hard to get accurate information sometimes. But it's all a reflection. You know, India, Argentina, Turkey, South Africa, all these areas, emerging markets, are areas of significant problems, especially as the U.S. weakens and or the dollar rises, either one. The problem with their currencies is that they correspondingly decline, and if they decline, then their inflation goes up, and they have to raise their interest rates to protect themselves from capital flight out of the country, and that slows down their economy, and they get inflation, import inflation, and at the same time, they get a slowdown in the real economy and recession. Okay, moving on to another topic here. Well, the last week, what have we seen? Billionaires calling for raising taxes. Whoa, billionaires want to raise their taxes? You know, guys like Soros and Gates and Simmons from the Pritzker family, billionaires in Chicago, right? Facebook's Hughes, big stockholder, right? I think it's the daughter or the daughter-in-law of Berkshire Hathaway, you know, which is one of the big investors, right? They call for a moderate wealth tax of 1/10 of 1%, 1/10 of 1% on billionaires. right? 0.1% wealth tax on their assets, I guess. Because if you talk about wealth, you talk about assets. You're not talking about money flows, income flows. Well, why are they doing this? You know, what's going on with these billionaires? Well, you know, oftentimes businesses will propose legislation to head off what looks like legislation that's coming down the track and can't be stopped, and that's more radical and threatening, right? They'll put a softer version into the pot, the legislative pot, to give an excuse for more of their friends to support something less onerous in terms of reducing their interests. This happens whenever people get so obviously discontent that they will go for more radical solutions and tell their you know, their legislatures, this is what they want. Well, we're seeing that pressure build on inequality, you know, the inequality thing going on in this country, accelerating year after year, right? The wealthy 1% getting over 20% of all the national income every year, right? And that's a national income pie that keeps growing, so it's 20% of more and more. Who knows exactly how much it is, because they do lie from time to time when they report their taxable income. Probably higher, not lower, right? But okay, official is 20-22%, whatever that is, right? The wealthy 1%. Well, these are clearly the wealthiest 1%. These are the wealthiest 0.1% and 0.01% of 1%. These are the billionaires, right? So I think this is partly that you know, they're more prescient than most of their class, and they see you know, a reaction coming on this inequality issue, and you know, they're trying to head it off with something less onerous, right? A wealth tax of only 0.1% Now, you know, Elizabeth Warren has called for a wealth tax as well on multimillionaires with more than 50 million in assets, a wealth tax, which she claims will raise about 30 billion a year, you know, and you know, it's kind of a tepid proposal. More significant, I think, is Bernie Sanders' financial transactions tax, right? Why not tax the process by which the billionaires become billionaires? In other words, the investing in financial markets, in stocks and bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange, properties, etc., right? Why not tax that process? That's what a financial transactions tax is really about. Not a wealth tax. In other words, after you got all your money, we're going to come and ask for a little bit of it back. That's a wealth tax. Well, you know, Elizabeth estimates $275 billion over a decade from her wealth tax. Well, you know, my financial transactions tax proposals of several years ago, I was making this proposal back, I think, in 2013. And I did some estimates at the time, and a 1% tax on stock trades, a 1% tax on every $1,000 bond trade, and a 0.1% tax on all foreign exchange currency trades, buying and selling currencies, gold and so forth, and on derivatives, would produce almost $1 trillion a year in income. $1 trillion a year. You know, because you're going to be taxing not just American investors investing in the stock market in the U.S., but all these global investors are going to get taxed too. And certainly they can bear the cost of 1% or 0.1% on their trade. you know, consider the fact that the volume, the magnitude of currency trades, which is mostly for dollars in the world, and dollars the trading currency, 85% of all trade is done with dollars, right? It amounts to $5 trillion as is exchanged in currencies every day. $5 trillion every day. So, you know, 1/100th or 1/10th or 1% on dollar currency transactions. You imagine the magnitude of the revenue could be brought in? And it's certainly, you know, 1/10th or 1% is not going to prevent the purchasing of currencies any more than a 1% tax, you know, on a $1,000 bond trade is going to do the same. You know, keep in mind, transactions taxes, that's a sales tax on the wealthy buying and selling securities. You know, don't we pay a sales tax of 8-9% in some counties? You know, when we go and buy, everyday stuff at the store. Yeah, we even pay, I think in California now, 5% or 4.5% tax on buying food. Well, why can't we have a sales tax on rich buying what they like to buy, stocks and bonds, etc.? Financial transactions tax would bring in a lot more revenue than a wealth tax. Well, anyway, these billionaires are at least saying, oh, we feel, you know, we got so much money now, you know, we can give some of it back. And this is just a segment of the capitalist class, maybe guilty about what they got and are, you know, willing to give some back. But, you know, there's an ulterior motive here, too. And the ulterior motive is, you know, head off even something more onerous, perhaps. And also, you know, if I give up and pay more taxes, you know, then I can do some other things with my money. A Harris poll this past February showed that 74% of U.S. voters support a higher tax, on the super wealthy. Warren's wealth tax, of course, was here. I got the figures. 2% on assets over $50 million. And she claims, by the way, this is $275 billion a year. So about $2.75 trillion over a decade. You know, even a 2% wealth tax brings in huge amounts of money. But, you know, Sanders... and my proposal for financial transaction tax would bring in 3-4 times as much, right? Okay. All right. So what we've got here is the inequality issue has become a widespread issue. And we've got even the billionaires saying, well, maybe we should do something about this, right? Certainly, since the capital gains from stock buybacks and dividend payouts have been accelerating, as I said, you know, it's getting $1.5 trillion this year. I mean, God, is there anything more obscene than the wealthy shareholders stuffing their pockets to the tune of $1.5 trillion a year? You know, that's what the inequality is driving, the inequality. It's not simply that wages aren't rising. You know, that's not the big factor here. It's that capital incomes are accelerating, you know, asymptotically, or I forgot the term. Anyway, they're accelerating, you know, faster and faster, right? And we got wage stagnation and even decline in wages going on when you adjust them for inflation and when you start considering the 50 million people who are unemployed and or underemployed in this country, not just look at full-time employed wages, right, or look at wages and hours worked, but just look at wages adjusted accurately for inflation, you know, you get negative. There's no growth inflation. That's a big misrepresentation. And then pension money is declining, real pensions, right? People are having to pay more and more for their health costs, shifting, right? So, no, you know, 100 million, 130 million households, you know, that work for a living instead of invest, they're stagnant, at best, stagnant. Okay. And meanwhile, corporations are flooding their shareholders with trillion plus every year for 7 years now, rising of buybacks and dividends. And as I said before, that's what's keeping the stock market up, right? Now, it's interesting to note that at the same time this past week, evidence that Trump is trying to give his wealthy friends an even further tax cut. He believes that he can administratively, without going through Congress, he can give them another capital gains tax cut. Well, what is this capital gains tax cut, this administrative tax cut that's being pushed through? It's indexing. In other words, index the tax cut for inflation, so that you can add more money every year and not pay the higher, get more money every year from capital gains and not pay a higher capital gains rate. Yeah, index your taxation. Well, what about indexing ours, right? Index my property taxes. Well, that's for them. That's not for us. Okay. So, billionaires calling for a tax cut for various reasons here, while Trump is trying to cut taxes even more for his rich friends. Which brings to another topic here about billionaires. Okay, what is that? Well, the billionaires are launching a new ideological offensive. Against what? And who? Who are these guys? Well, I've been watching this fellow, David Rubenstein, on Bloomberg, right? Bloomberg's really pushing this guy. He has a show on Bloomberg where he interviews big capitalists, you know, and, you know, it's a big puff piece every week here. You know, oh, what great innovative, far-seeing, visionary people who got rich because, you know, they were visionaries and they worked hard and all the other nonsense, right? He interviews these vultures and, you know, does a soft job interviewing them. It's a popular show for investors. They like it. I watch it once in a while just to see what they're thinking. And, of course, Rubenstein now is David Rubenstein. He was one of the founders, by the way, of Carlyle Group, which is this billionaire private equity firm company that does business all around the world that's tied in with the Saudis, you know, and also with the Bush family. Bush family has been big participants in the Carlyle Fund here since the 90s. Anyway, private equity, shadow bank, only the rich, you know, get to play with these guys, and you got to bring millions to the table. And Rubenstein, one of the founders, you know, and then he starts this talk show, you know, more sophisticated talking heads, you know, not as crude as the Hannitys and as the other clowns. But now he's going around, and the conferences and interviews and everything pushing this critique of some of the new ideas, progressive ideas, that are beginning to emerge. You know, like Medicare for All, Green New Deal, student debt relief, free college tuition, wealth taxes, transaction taxes, and MMT, modern money theory. He's attacking all of these. And this past week he had a conference interview here with one of his shadow banking buddies, notorious Paul Singer, head of the Elliott Management. I think it's an equity firm. It might be a hedge fund. Anyway, he's one of the biggies, right? Paul Singer is famous for ripping off Argentina early in the 2000 decade. And then when you got a more democratic government there under the Kirchners took over, they refused to pay his exorbitant interest and charges here on the loans that he gave Argentina when it went bankrupt in the early 2000s there. Right? The IMF bailed Argentina out. And when the IMF does that, it always brings in private investors who get a taste of the deal, you see, consortium. And Singer was one of them. And he refused to compromise with the new government and pay something. And he just held out for years and years until we, got Trump in here and got a new government forced by the U.S. In Argentina, the Macri government. And the first thing the Macri government did when it got elected was say, okay, we're paying off Singer and his buddies $4 billion, right? Yeah, I mean, Argentina was in economic straits, but they found enough money to pay off the vultures, the Singers. Yeah, they did that. And immediately then Macri goes to New York and gets other big loans from New York bankers, which Macri and his business buddies skim off the top, right? So, they personally make a lot of money from this deal by making the Argentine treasury pay off the hedge funds. Singer, well, this is Paul Singer, see? These are the guys who are running the economy now in the U.S. These are the shadow bankers, the investment bankers, Goldman Sachs and so forth. They're all the same. Rubenstein and Singer were on this panel at the Aspen Institute this past week. Aspen, this is up there in Colorado. Elites go there and they have conferences and so forth, right? And very, very clear, both of them took turns attacking concepts like modern money theory, Medicare for all, and socialism, which is now on the radar screen, you see. Typically, Medicare for all. Oh, it's too expensive, they say. It'll raise debt. Oh, we can't afford Medicare for all. Oh, it's going broke, et cetera, et cetera. Is it too costly, Medicare for all? Not really. Not when you compare it to what people are paying for a broken down health insurance system. Kaiser Foundation releases a report every year on what the costs are for private health insurance. Okay, and what's the cost? Well, today, if you want private health insurance for a family of four, the average cost in premiums alone is $20,000 a year. This is up from $5,000 at the beginning of the 2000s, 2001. It was $5,000 a year. Now it's $20,000 a year. That's like almost $1,700 every month just for premiums, right? That's not counting co-pays and deductibles. And that's not taking into consideration a whole number of procedures now that aren't covered, that you got to pay out of pocket, you see, which really is raising the price. So $20,000 a year, that's the average. Compare that to Medicare. What does it cost for Medicare? If you're on Medicare, well, you paid 1.45% of your income while you worked. Okay, didn't 1.45, hardly impacts you. Now you pay, on average, $135 deductible once a year. Once a year. And that gives you 100% hospital and 80% of physician. Okay? For $135 a year. Now, if you're rich, if you're above, several hundred thousand dollars annual income, you'll pay more than $135. But most folks, if you're making under $150,000 a year, you're going to pay $135. I don't know what the breakdown really is, but that's about it. You're going to pay $135. Okay. Well, compare that 1.45 that you're not paying any more percent and $135 a year. Compare that to $20,000 a year plus deductibles, plus copays, plus reduced coverage. And if you're one of the many millions now, you can't afford to pay $1,600-$1,700 a month. So you buy one of these disaster packages where you have a $3,000-$5,000 deductible every year before insurance pays anything. Yeah, millions of people. That's all they can afford now. Well, you know, according to Rubenstein, you know, people aren't going to want to give up, you know, their great private health insurance. Well, maybe billionaires like him, you know, it's just a fraction of what they make, the cost. But for most folks, it's unaffordable. It's unaffordable anymore. All right, so they think everybody's going to I want to stay with the health insurance, and that another false argument is that you know, you're going to force you off of your private health insurance. No, if you want to keep paying more, you know, go ahead. And you don't want to sign up for Medicare for All, go ahead. Right. Anyway, the economics of Medicare for All aren't even comparable to what the cost is. You know, we're paying like 20% of GDP, approaching $4 trillion a year in this country for health care. $4 trillion. No other country even comes close. And where's it going to? Most of it's going to middlemen who don't provide any health services at all. They're paper pushers, health insurance companies. But they're the biggest lobbyist spenders in Washington. Okay, so, you know, attacking Medicare for All. Another interesting attack topic here is MMT, Modern Money Theory. Modern Money Theory. Well, what is Modern Money Theory? I don't want to get too deep into the complexity of it, but basically it's saying, why don't we, if we can't pass legislation here for spending on infrastructure and social programs and alternative energy and all the things that are need to be spent on that fiscally will produce economic growth, right? If we can't do that through Congress, well, let's just print the money. Let's just create the money and spend the money through creation, because it doesn't matter. These government debts don't matter. That's the argument of modern money theory, essentially. Well, you know, the Rubensteins and Singers didn't like that, and they really trashed it in their Aspen conference. But wait a minute. Come on, David Rubenstein. That's exactly what QE was for you folks. QE, the central bank, essentially electronically printed money and gave it to you. You know, bought up your bad investments at pennies on the dollar, bailed you out, gave you cash, and then allowed you to borrow at 0.15 interest from the Fed for another 7 years. Yeah, that's what QE was, and it gave you pumped more than $5 trillion into your pockets. And, of course, it allowed some of your big companies like Apple, with $250 billion of cash, to sell corporate bonds in order to distribute in buybacks and dividend payouts. Didn't need any money, but money was so cheap, it was financially better for Apple to sell bonds and pay a minimal interest on the bond to whoever bought it, and then turn it around and give that money to shareholders while it sat on its cash hoard at $250 billion. You know, that was low interest rates. Thank you, Federal Reserve. Thank you, Ben Bernanke. Thank you, Janet Yellen. Yeah, that's what that was all about. QE. MMT is just QE stood on its head. They liked QE, which was MMT for them, but they don't like MMT QE for us. Anyway, they go through all the gyrations here attacking MMT because it's gaining some some recognition, as is Medicare for All. But they're really going after socialism. You see, everything that used to be a social program or infrastructure spending or whatever in the 60s and 70s now is called socialism. Yeah. Fiscal spending for everybody but them is socialism. Yeah. MMT for them, that's good, right? MMT for us, no, not good. Socialism, right? Tax cuts for them, that's good. Tax cuts for us, no, that's socialism, right? New Deal, Green New Deal, that's socialism. Taxing the rich, oh, that's socialism. You know, no wonder two-thirds of millennials now say they, you know, they like this idea maybe of socialism because what they got now just ain't working. Yeah. Of course, socialism for them, right, at this point means none of the above, none of what we got, right? Let's try that. Yeah. So, you know, if the big guys, billionaires and so forth, keep dinging socialism for things that people really want and need, you know, they just may be helping the cause of spreading the idea that, well, maybe socialism isn't so bad. Okay, so that's the billionaires on an ideological offensive here globally. And that's been, that's going to intensify here, right? More and more. They're fighting back against these new ideas of Medicare for All, MMT, Green New Deal, student debt relief. You know, one of my favorite topics, student debt relief, you know. Why the hell is the government charging students 6.8% on their loans when it, for 7 years, it gave bankers and shadow bankers and investors loans at 0.15%? And today, it's still only a couple percent, you know. Why can they go and borrow from the banks for less than 2%? Why they charge the kids 6.8%. That's government gouging our kids. That's all that is. That's all that student loan gimmick is. And, you know, it goes right back to the higher education institutions that just raise their tuition. They just grab it and take it and hire more administrators, right? And pay millions more to football coaches. Yeah. Or buy Olympics, build Olympic swimming pools and, you know, suites instead of dormitories, right? Colleges are becoming, in some ways, some of them, resorts, a four-year diverted resort for youth, you know, instead of teaching. Well, it's not totally true because, you know, kids are living in their cars and going without food in some places, like in California, at UC Berkeley and places like that. And, of course, the faculty isn't getting it because two-thirds of all the faculty now are adjuncts, part-timers with no benefits. Yeah, so, but there's lots of administrators, yeah, more and more little empires, and heads of these college universities think they're corporate CEOs and got to get the same pay, right? And this whole $1.6 trillion now in student loans is feeding the whole thing. And let's charge the kids 6.8% on all that. Well, something's really wrong here. As wrong as what's wrong with the healthcare system. Yeah. Oh, well, you know, let's call it socialism. And let's go after it. Can't have that, right? Okay, David and Paul Singer, you know, go spread your lies. This is ideology. This is what ideology is about. It's about distorting ideas, changing their meaning internally with language games in order to obfuscate and lie about what it really means, right? In order to protect the interests of folks who might have to pay more money because of these new ideas. That's what ideology is. Okay, that's it for today, and we'll be back next week, I'm sure, talking about the G20 and trade, and we'll see what a impact that has on the financial markets. Oh,